Page Fright is recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. These territories were stolen, and they are now the space where I inhabit and live. But the guests you're hearing on this podcast often come from different territories across what is now known as Canada. I encourage our guests, and I encourage you as well, listening at home, to take a moment to consider the territory you're on, its history, and how you might have come to belong here. Welcome back to Page Fright. My name's Andrew French. I'm on Instagram at Andrew W. French, and this, of course, is the world's first podcast that I host. Wow. Here we are. February episode. Best Canadian Poetry 2024. You're reading this title, and you're clicking on this episode because you're a really, really dedicated Page Fright listener, and you're like, Andrew, what the heck is this? Have you just decided what the best poetry is going to be this year already? No. I haven't done that. Somebody else has. And let me tell you about the concept for this episode in case you're unfamiliar. I've done a couple of these before, but every year this publisher, Biblioasis, they're fantastic. They put out this collection, this anthology called Best Canadian Poetry and then whatever year it's coming out in. And effectively what it is they task a poet with something that I thoroughly believe would drive me insane. That's not to say I don't want to do it someday. I think it'd be kind of cool, but it would be, like, cool until it drives me insane. The task is as follows. They are to read every single poem published in a Canadian journal or published internationally by a Canadian poet and pick what they decide to be the quote-unquote best Canadian poetry for that year. So, really difficult task because that's a lot of reading. Really difficult task because what the heck is a best Canadian poem? And the second half of that difficulty is what I really wanted to dig into this year. As I said, I've done this previously. If you like this episode, you can go back and listen to some former iterations. But I really wanted to dig into what makes a best Canadian poem. And so this is something that I've asked each of our three readers today. Yes, there are three readers, three guests, each of whom have a poem published in this collection that I guess was also previously published elsewhere. We'll get into the collection in just a moment, but there's a couple things I wanted to say off the top. So some housekeeping for you. Number one, I want to thank Rob Taylor for helping me put this together. Rob is a fantastic friend of the show and, shot me an email and said, hey, do you want to do this? And I was like, absolutely. So here we are doing it. Second, Rob has been organizing an event, a reading at Massey Arts Society on February 20th for Best Canadian Poetry 2024. Now, this was part of the reason I wanted to put this episode out this week, was to get people there. But it turns out the event's so solid that it's already sold out. So if you can, you know, I don't know. I don't think you can get in now. I think it's fully, but regardless, this event's going down. So if you've got yourself a seat, congratulations. You can listen to this in advance and get pumped. If you haven't got yourself a seat, don't worry. Don't hesitate. It's going to be okay. I've got three of the readers from that event on today's episode. So you're going to get a little taste of what it would be like anyway. Okay. Let's jump right in. Let's jump into these interviews because I feel like I've been rambling for a long time. I don't think there's anything else I need to mention off the top of the episode. So what we'll do is interview, quick chat with me, introducing the next person, interview, so on and so forth. Let's go to our first poet. So our first poet that I talked to for this episode is Nicholas Bradley. At the back of the collection, there is a bio and a brief explanation of the poem included for that poet by that poet. And so I'll be reading both of those things for you for each of these poets. First up, Nicholas Bradley lives in Victoria, BC. He is the author of two books of poetry, Rain Shadow, which came out with University of Alberta Press in 2018, and Before Combustion, which just came out last year. You'll hear us talking a bit about it with Gaspereau Press. He teaches in the Department of English at the University of Victoria. Of his poem included in this collection, Atmospheric River, that's the title, Bradley writes, in the late autumn of 2021, British Columbia and the state of Washington suffered calamitous flooding as a result of extraordinary rain. The so-called atmospheric river, the term was suddenly on everyone's lips, led to what has been deemed the costliest natural disaster in the history of the province. An old friend in Calgary told me that the phrase was new to him, which gave me an opening. In the rest of the poem, I tried to suggest the difficulty of finding the right words for an almost unimaginable event. But I also hope to show that during a crisis, now our permanent condition it seems, language, art, and friendship persist. We go on, and a poem might cross the mountains, even when the highways are closed. I can't think of rivers in the Pacific Northwest without thinking of Richard Hugo, and I borrowed a thing or two from his poetry. He died before I might have met him, but I like to imagine that our poems give each other a cordial nod. Here I am chatting with our first guest today, Nicholas Bradley. So, my first interview for this episode, Best Canadian Poetry, is with Nicholas Bradley. How's it going?
I'm well, thanks.
I'm super excited to talk to you about this poem. It was one of my favorites when I read through the collection, and so I'm super stoked that I got a chance to sit down with you. And I also understand you are heading to Vancouver for the reading, is that correct?
I am.
Exciting. So, if you are in Vancouver, I imagine Nicholas probably not over in Vancouver a ton for readings, so this is a good chance to see him read. And this poem is really fantastic, and we'll get into questions about it. I have a ton. But before we do that, could I get you to read the poem so we can get acquainted with it?
Yeah, I would love to. Atmospheric River. Dear Kit, you said the storms taught you something new, a weather term you hadn't known. Well, you and Grim Me and everybody else. What's a pedant to do but consult the good book? The dictionary swings and whiffs. Phrases? None. Etymologies? None. Definitions? None. Quotations? None. Full texts? Take a wild guess. I look at these sweet nothings through my own zeros, leer at drone footage of the crumbled Coquihalla Highway and the streaming porn of liquefied cities. Above my mask, I'm always fogged. Water. Water everywhere. You tell me it's drier than normal on your side of the Rockies. The rain got stuck in traffic. I know the bow a little, elbow too, and my lips are cracked on your behalf. I dreamt I was an ocean and woke up soaked and coughing, bedclothes a lake. Aren't all rivers atmospheric? That's why we love them, breathe them through our gills, and taste them with our feet. The skylight's drumming. When this cold abates, I'll write some more. Till then, I dispatch your rightful precipitation and all my best from this swamped island. Nick.
Awesome. Okay. I'm super excited to talk about this. My first question for you, I think, is probably the hardest one, so I'll get it out of the way right away. But I know you write a lot of nature poetry. I've read your previous book, and I'm familiar with some of the published poems online and stuff. So I am wondering, hard question, what makes a good nature poem?
Well, that is a good question and a hard question. I don't know that a good nature poem is any different from a good non-nature poem. I think I would venture that all the same qualities that make a good poem, whatever a writer or a reader thinks that might be, all those same qualities make for a good nature poem. So in my case, I think one of the qualities I in general that I try to aim for and that I was aiming for in this poem is not coming at the subject head on. So thinking about indirection, and I would say that that's a quality I strive for regardless of what I'm writing about. Not everyone's gonna want that same quality, but a good poem is a good poem regardless of what you mean by good, independent of the subject matter. But then as soon as I say that, I think of another point of view. Maybe one way to answer the question is to say that a good nature poem is one that is really thinking hard about what the nature poem means as a type of poem, and thinking hard about what nature itself is. In 2024 or in 2021, when I first started thinking about this poem, you can't think about nature in the same way as people might have been thinking about it in 1924 or 1824. So I think there has to be some self-awareness on the part of the writer that spills into the poem itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that self-awareness and the way that it comes through in this poem in particular is the epistolary form, the fact that you're writing as a letter in this poem, which I really like. I have a whole chapbook of epistolary poems, so I'm very partial to them. But I think it works really well here. So I guess I'm wondering what drew you to forming this poem as a letter.
Well, it came out of a conversation that I had with a friend around the time of the really bad flooding that was a result of an atmospheric river here in BC, which of course you will remember well. And the beginning of the poem comes out of that conversation. My friend said that he hadn't heard the term, and I think that was true of a lot of people, myself included. I might have read it somewhere, but it wasn't on the tip of my tongue, as it were. And suddenly everyone was using this phrase, but I really felt thankful to my friend Kit for this conversation. I thought he had given me a good start to the poem, so I wanted to reciprocate in a way. But then I was also just thinking about friendship and distance more generally. So this is a post-lockdown poem, not quite a post-pandemic poem, but it's from the time when things were starting to seem a bit more normal, and I wanted to write something that in a way reflected the feeling I had of wanting to make connections across distance after we'd all lived through this truly one of a kind moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I say, I think this works really well. And one of the things that I love about this poem and the poems of yours that I've read more generally is the way in which it, I feel like, okay, I talked about a good poem, which is a very loaded question, but for me personally, one of the things I love in a poem is the ability to kind of gesture towards something universal with a very personal example. And so in this poem, we see that happening. I mean, we have your discovery of this term through the friend, and then, this gesture towards a larger climate crisis, which is really difficult because, as a writer, when you're putting this together, I imagine you can tell me if this is true or not, that it would be difficult to write a poem like this because you're at once kind of juggling your own personal side of the poem with the larger, overarching, here's the climate crisis that we're facing sort of thing. How do you kind of balance those two as a writer when you're sitting down to draft a poem like this?
Well, I think about the climate crisis all the time, constantly. But I'm not sure that as a poet I can write about the climate crisis as such. It's too vast a topic. It's intractable. But then, for me anyway, poetry really comes out of my experience. And I don't know that anyone experiences the climate crisis as such. They experience its local effects, certainly. We all experience weather, and I think a lot of us have a sense that weather is changing. So the best I can do, I think, is to try to gesture towards, as you're saying, this bigger picture, without trying to get too far into the abstractions of something as overwhelmingly large as climate crisis. So I guess I'm thinking about what happens here in the place I live in, the place that I call home, what's happening with my friends, what's happening in the world as I can see it. And I think the best that I can do is to try to observe what's going on, witness it maybe, and try to turn it into something that might resonate with readers, even if their particular experiences are different from the ones that I'm writing about in the first instance.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really like about this poem is the sense in which, especially older poetry, you think of the poet telling the reader something and saying, this is the way that things are, and so on. But what I really like about the speaker in this poem is the ability to admit, like, no, I actually don't know what an atmospheric river is. I'm eager to learn, but I don't have that knowledge immediately. And it's a poem of discovering rather than telling, which is really, really nice. Is that something you were kind of conscious of when you sat down to write this poem? Was like you wanted it to be more exploratory in that way? Or is that something that you consider more broadly? I know you've got a book out now too that we'll talk about in a sec, but is that something that you consider a lot in your poetry, is having that exploratory feel to it?
I think so. Now that you mention it, I don't know how conscious I was of it, but I think that's a nice way to talk about what poems do in general. So maybe I'll answer by saying that I hope my poems are exploratory. I think they, I'll leave it for others to judge this about my writing, but when I read poems that I enjoy and admire, I see that quality that you're talking about. I think they find their way towards a meaning, or a set of meanings, a set of ideas, even if they don't seem to know where they're going at the start. And that makes it fun for the reader, I think. You start the poem somewhere, and you end up in a completely different place, maybe not one that you expected to end up in. But that quality of surprise is something I look for when I'm reading. And I'd go back to your previous question about climate crisis. We're all hearing about climate crisis all the time. It's impossible to escape. And so if a And the news is never good. So if a poem about climate can surprise the reader, well, that's really important, I think. There's a kind of monotone nature to the way it tends to get reported, right? Things are not looking good. And certainly I don't think I would want to write a poem that is trying to put a positive spin on things necessarily, but if a poem can give the reader another way of seeing things, or of understanding things, then I think that's a really positive thing. And yeah, surprise, discovery, the unexpected. I mean, these are all virtues of a poem, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. And I think that's what makes this poem, I think part of this collection is that it's really difficult to write a poem about nature, or more specifically the climate crisis, and say something new or generative. I do think that's a really difficult task, because it is something, like you say, that we're kind of drowning in. We're surrounded by this. And so it is difficult to come up with new content on that, and it's really well done here, so I'm very excited about that. Before I forget, you have a book out with Gaspereau. It's called Before Combustion, and I know nature has been integral to your writing. Is this poem similar in that way to a lot of what we can expect from that book?
Well, it's similar in the sense that it's concerned with environmental change and the future, our future lives, our future places. But it's a little bit different from some of the others in the book because it is squarely about a particular climate event. A lot of the poems are more focused on indoor living. This one's concerned with the broader world and what's been in the news. A lot of the other poems in the book are a little bit closer to home.
Interesting. Okay. So I wanted to ask too, for my own personal curiosity, is this a poem that you were writing while working on that book, or were those timelines separate from each other?
Well, the poem, the poem, as I said, is from late in 2021. The poems in this book were mostly written from about 2018 on. So, don't quote me on this, but it's one of the poems in the book that I wrote later in the process. But I'm a slow worker. This book collects poems that I wrote over a number of years. So I guess the way I see it, it all comes more or less from the same period of time.
Interesting. Okay, awesome. My last question for you, Nick, and I lied maybe up front when I said that the first one was the hardest. This one is probably a little bit more difficult. Put yourself in the head of the editor of this collection for a moment. If you're looking for a poem to add to Best Canadian Poetry, you're editing a volume of this. What might be a quality or two that you're looking for?
That is a hard question. Well, I can give you a kind of cheating answer, which maybe doesn't count. This is Best Canadian Poetry in English. And so in some totally practical but ideal version of this collection, there would be poems in the other languages that poets in the places called Canada are writing in. And I think another possible way of answering the question is to say if the annual collection wasn't just one book but five volumes. There could be just more and more and more. I mean, any book can only be so long, but it seems to me that there are a lot of best Canadian poems every year. So, in a way, as much as it's lovely to have one slim collection to read, it would be nice to have more and more and more. But I think the answer you're looking for, if I were adding poems to this volume, I don't know that I'd look for something different. I'd just look for more of the qualities we've been talking about. Surprise is a word that keeps coming up for me as a quality I look for in poems, the unexpected. I guess I don't know what I would be looking for. I would just want to be on the lookout for something to catch me off guard. I want the poem to make itself known as the poem that should go in the book, for reasons that I didn't have in mind when I was setting out to look for it. So yeah, poems that take the reader aback.
Gotcha. So kind of a less of knowing what you're looking for and knowing what it is when you see it, yeah, I like that. Yeah, it's a difficult question, but I have to ask it because every year when I talk to the editors about these, I have to ask that question. I think it's the most difficult task in poetry to put this together. And so interested to get your opinion there. Yeah, so this has been me chatting with Nicholas Bradley. It's been great to talk to you about your poem and to talk a little bit about your book that's, as I said, out now with Gaspro. I'm going to put a link to it down below the episode so people can check it out. I really recommend it. It's on my pile to read, so I'm super excited to dig into it. But Nicholas, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for these great questions, even the hard ones. It's been a lot of fun chatting.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that interview with Nicholas Bradley. Do check out his book. There's a link below. I'm super excited about it. Still in my pile to read, but I will be getting to it soon. I am very hopeful of that. There's just such a backlog these days, folks. Our next guest is Matt Rader. Let me tell you a little bit about Matt Rader. Matt Rader lives in Kelowna, British Columbia. He's the author of five collections of poems, most recently Ghost Hawk with Nightwood in 2021. He teaches creative writing at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. Rader writes of his poem, "On June 29, 2021, the temperature reached a record-breaking 46.7 degrees in Kelowna. The cultural milieu at the time was also very heated. The pandemic continued unabated. Vaccines had only been widely available for a few months and the backlash was growing. The discovery of 215 unmarked graves at the former Kamloops Residential School, only 100 kilometers from Kelowna, had been announced a few weeks prior. Several churches in the region had been deliberately set ablaze. Heat Dome, the title of this poem, is a fairly literal account of what I did, thought, and felt that morning." Here I am chatting with Matt Rader. Our next interview is with Matt Rader. Matt, how's it going?
Great. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you on. I was really excited when I kind of got a list together of the people I'd be chatting to, and you were one of them because I really, really enjoyed your poem in this collection. I'm super excited to talk about it. But before we get into all of that good stuff, could I get you to read the poem for us so we could get acquainted with your work?
Yeah, this is Heat Dome. It was from Event Magazine. We swam in the lake at 10 a.m. before it grew too hot. The five of us, two divorced parents, our teenagers, my mother, at a little public access where the neighbor with the tennis courts has a lakeside infinity pool. I have a spider bite on my hip, the exact pinks of the wildfire smoke-filtered sunlight. In some milkamine and Osoyoos and Penticton, the ashes of Catholic churches can't cool. Spider bite sky, rashy light. In Xanadu, did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, is what I remember most vividly from grade 12 poetry. Infinity is when it never ends. We swam out to the nearest buoy, a white and pink ball on the surface of the lake. We followed its shadowy chain down to a shadowy slab of concrete in the milfoil at 15 feet. What is pleasure without an ending? When the spider bit me, I didn't feel anything. Back on the beach on a slip of public property beneath a bower of maple trees, we were cool. How could we be happy, we asked, but we were happy. The spider had its own source of heat. It was something inside me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for reading that. I'm so excited to talk about this poem. I have a bunch of questions, but the one that's jumping out at me first, because I just heard you read, is kind of about pacing. So one of the things that really caught my eye without even reading through the poem, just from looking at it first glance, was the difference in line length. I found that really interesting here, and I wanted to know, A, if you've played with that difference in line length before, and B, how you know where to end a line.
Those are very good questions. And on one hand, of course, they're a little bit intuitive. This poem comes from a collection of poems that will be out in the spring. And those poems all have this kind of variation in line length. So they're really playing with like rhythm and enjambment, and the kind of like it's not a stricture that I gave to myself in a like a the front of my mind, but it's pretty clear to me when I look at the poems that one practices that no line following the no line is the same as the line before it in length. So there's always like this variation all the way through. And so I'm one thing in this whole collection and in this poem in particular, and this is actually not the final version of this poem, but it's the poem that it, as it appeared in Advent a year and a half ago or whatever. The each line is a unit. So for me, I'm looking at like each line as a kind of its own rhetorical or like rhythmic but all imagistic unit. And the enjambments are important. So you ask me, how do I know the line, where to break the line? Some of it is how long did the, was the line before it? So I need to make a shorter line or longer line depending on how that is playing out. Another is what are kind of the potential rhetorical units within that enjambment. And I have some other like thoughts. I'm like loosely metering the poems, so like I'm paying attention to where the stress is in relation to the rhetoric. So if we are like trying to make points of heightened rhetorical meaning line up with points of metrical stress.
Hey, interesting. So, okay. Very in-depth answer. I've asked this question before on the show. I've definitely asked, where do you end a line? And I'm gonna ask you about endings in a little bit too. But most people have told me it's intuitive, like you began by saying. But one of the things that, because I was asked this question a couple years ago, which inspired me to start asking it on the podcast. And my exact answer was, I try to think of a line as a unit of language. And so you, when you said, I think of a line as a unit, I got very excited. So this is perfect. So I wanted to ask too, okay, you talked about rhythm and meter and a lot of kind of like gestured towards some formal concepts of poetry. One of my favorite parts of this poem is when you write about, you quote, and then you say, this is what you remember most vividly from grade 12 poetry. I wanted to ask you, I'm a youngish poet and I'm kind of like figuring it out. So for me, grade 12 poetry, maybe not that far behind me, definitely undergrad poetry, not that far behind me. But for you, how has your perspective on poetry changed since you were in grade 12 or since you were introduced to poetry in the first place?
That's a great question. I won't bring out the old cliche of the before I practiced, mountains were just mountains, and then I practiced and they weren't mountains anymore. That whole bit later, they're mountains again. And something in the question though makes me think about this, that like it's the practicing of the writing of poetry that has changed my relationship to poetry. And I remember the first poems I wrote as a kid, and I have this very clear memory of like writing these haiku with my mom after visiting a park on Vancouver Island. I grew up on Vancouver Island, so we would go into this park, and that I was suddenly aware of how different it was to make a poem than it was to read a poem. And you know, I made it maybe I've been like 7 or 8 or 9 years old. And in my like what's different mostly between now and say grade 12 is like I wasn't a serious writer of poems. And I had didn't have like 25 years of writing poems practice. And so now I think I sort of two kind of maybe a pure contradictory like feelings about poetry, which is one, to follow like Robert Bringhurst or Harold Greenidge or somebody like that. We're not the only species that writes poetry, and there's many poetries in the world, and they come in all kinds of languages and cultures, and I don't just mean like human cultures or human languages. So on one sense, my sense of poetry has expanded dramatically, and that's something I wouldn't have understood reading Kubla Khan And like our literally our lit 12 teacher had us draw Kublai Khan. Like, what did we think was happening in the in this poem? And on the other hand, I can see that that poem is about poetry. That poem is about the source of poetry and what it and I the importance of the history of poetry has only grown also. Like, I see the direct relevance of somebody like Coleridge to my life now and to my writing and poetry now, in a way that I couldn't have predicted when I was 17 years old.
Totally. Yeah. No, I love that answer. It's true. It's interesting how the more you learn about it, the more you can see those connections, but at the same time as you're writing. I mean, I did a lot of education in English and learning poems and that sort of thing, but as a writer, it's a very different hat that you wear. And it's so interesting how those things differ from one another so extensively. So yeah, I really, really love that answer. Not to keep throwing quotes at you from your own poem, but I have one more here for you.
Sure.
Okay, you also write one of my favorite lines, if not my favorite line from this poem, "What is pleasure without an ending?" So I am wondering how you end not a line, but a poem, because the ending to the poem be really important, and I think it is here. So what do you look for as a writer when you're ending a poem, and as a reader? I'm going to add that twist given your last answer.
As a writer, I think from I mean, again, this is one of those questions that you could answer a different way every day of the week if you wanted to, and they would all be true, right? They would all be accurate. What comes to my mind, maybe with this poem and thinking about the poems I've written over the last few years, is a sense of energy that, like, some kind of energy has, some point has been reached in which the energy of that poem is balanced. And by balanced, I don't mean like stopped, but I mean like is in a kind of like resonant harmonic place. And I could probably go back through the poem and talk about like how that happens, like phrase by phrase or line by line, but in that's more than we can do here. That's the kind of like the general sense that I have. It is sometimes really hard though. And like I have a poem in my new book that I had a different ending for, and I cut the ending, and I'm still not sure that I like the energy of like the place. Because sometimes you want to sticking the landing isn't so much about like ending it, stopping it, and like wrapping it all up. In fact, that's usually a terrible decision. But it's giving enough form for the energy of the poem to like radiate. And sometimes if you cut it off too early, it's more like it kind of like spills out and is a little messy, or like it doesn't it feels like, oh, I wanted to go one more like gesture. There was one more thing. And so that's a more intuitive way of describing, I guess, than my answer about the line endings, although those things are related, right? Like you're tracking that energy all the way through in its various like habits of movement. It's like the ecology of that energy, and that energy is rhetorical, it's compositional, it has to do with the sounds of the poems, has to do with the resonant images, and like that's something that like in this poem there are these synecdochal relationships between the images of like the buoy, the sky, the spider bite, and like they have the same shape, and so they are like and colors, so they're kind of like there's some interplay between all of those things, and so you're measuring or assessing those as you come to the end of the poem, and maybe you make
Definitely.
the right decision and maybe you don't. For reading a poem, I think I like to feel like I've arrived somewhere where I wasn't expecting. And I say this like from I have a job teaching, like I teach creative writing, I teach people to write poems, and theoretically, I'm in the room while people are writing poems. Anyway, I note like I so I have poems that I go back to over and over again, right, as like models. And what's very amazing to me about those poems is that I can go back to them, and every time there's something I didn't really know before when I get to the end. Every time. And sometimes their poems are very, like, they seem very simple. And I find myself talking to somebody about them, and I think, oh yeah, I'm getting this new bit of valence, or this new tone that is coming through this poem that I haven't quite seen. And maybe it's that, like, each time I come with a slightly different set of glasses, let's say, like, or like my own like affective, like, register is variable. And so when I interact with the poem, that kind of relationship creates something new. But that's what I'm looking for at the end of the poem. I'm looking for at the end of the poem that I'm walking away, or I'm turning the page, or I'm stopped with something new, something I didn't know before. And
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah, no, go ahead.
I just want to say one thing. When I say didn't know before, it often arrives as a feeling that's like, I always knew this. Does that make sense? Like, oh, this thing I always knew, it's so true. It was always true, you know? But for me, those feelings are somewhat indistinguishable. Like, it's a new thing, and it's a true thing is an unchanging thing. So you probably recognize it because it was always there.
Right. And that can be a source of that resonance that you were talking about,
Yeah,
right? That
exactly.
comes at the ending. Yeah, that's really interesting. I love that. Man, I wish we had some more time. I got one last question for you. And I told you before we started recording there might be one hard question. I think this is the hardest.
Okay.
I'm asking it to everybody that I'm talking to you for this. If you were editing a Best Canadian Poetry volume collection anthology, what would you be looking for as an editor?
That is such a hard question. I'm like, I hope nobody ever asks me to do it. I mean, it's hard because one's sense of poetry is, there are many, many more poetries than I can ever read or engage with. And like, so I would probably be looking for those poems that invited me to expand my own aesthetic preferences. So I would want to go into the enterprise, trying to like things that I had never liked before. And I would want to meet poems that wanted to show me how I could do that, or like wanted to engage with me in some way that I would be moved by and entertained by, and like see the beauty in things that I hadn't seen. And I don't just mean like in the content of the poems, but like in the way they're made. Yeah. How's
No,
that?
that's a great answer. I know you don't want to do it based on your answer, but I would love to read a collection that you did put together based on that. That sounds super interesting.
I just don't want to do it because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
The sweetest reason not to do it. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time, Matt. I'm gonna put a link to your new book down below if I can, below the episode, so people can find it. What is the title of that book?
Called Fine.
Fine. Awesome. And who's it out with?
Nightwood. It'll be out in April.
Okay. Awesome. We'll keep an eye out for Fine with Nightwood. Thank you so much for this. I'm so excited to have had a chance to chat with you. I'm going to throw it back to me reading the next person's bio, and we'll go from there. So there you have it. That was me chatting with Matt Rader. We're on to our final interview here, folks. Coming down to the end of our Best Canadian Poetry 2024 episode, and we're rounding it off with a good one. This is Joanna Streetly reading her poem for us. So, Joanna Streetly has lived on the west coast of Vancouver Island since 1990. She is the published author of four books and has been listed for the FBCW Literary Writes Poetry Contest, the Canada Writes Creative Nonfiction Prize, and the Spectator's Shiva Nepal Award. Her work appears in literary magazines, anthologies, and Best Canadian Essays, 2017. From 2018 to 2020, she was the inaugural Tofino Poet Laureate. Of her poem, Streetly writes, "One June morning in 2018, I and many others began searching by motorboat, kayak, even on foot, for three young men whose boat had vanished 200 meters from the dock. Two of those men were my stepsons. I'd lived with them for 7 years, from when they were small enough to sit on my lap until they were old enough to squirm away. Now in their 30s, I'd last seen them only a few days before. That morning, full moon and spring tides created the lowest water of the year. Caught in the current's extreme grip, the boys had likely been swept miles out to sea. But maybe not? Javelins of light pierced the crown of the rainforest, struck the water, bounced off the gleaming seaweed. Everything was alive with newness. Even my task was new. I was looking for... what was I looking for? A hand waving? A person stranded on the rocks? A body submerged? As I paddled my kayak, a wolf paused at the edge of an island, staring out to sea. Pause in the water. Was it showing me where to look, or was it simply observing the beauty of the sunrise, paying homage to the longest days of the year? Everywhere I looked, there were signs like this. In lieu of finding the boys, I collected the signs. And over the months and years of fruitless searching, these signs began to populate my writing, eventually settling into this poem, Gyre. Here I am chatting with Joanna Streetly. Final guest for this episode. I didn't tell her that she's our final guest today, but the final poet that we're speaking with for the Best Canadian Poetry episode this year is Joanna Streetly. Joanna, how's it going?
It's going very well, thank you. It's actually not pouring with rain, which it has been doing for what feels like a lifetime.
You asked me where I was coming from. Where are you coming from that you're getting a break from the rain?
So I am sitting in the loft of my float house in Natchez, which is kind of the Kla'okwit name for Tofino, where I'm coming from.
Okay.
I'm looking out the window and the house is actually gently rocking as we're talking. So you may actually get a bit of vertigo because you might actually notice me moving a bit, but I'm not moving. It's my underpinnings that are moving.
Okay. What a fantastic, I've never done an interview with somebody from a floating house. So this is very exciting for me. And speaking of first, the first thing we need to do in our interview today is to ask you to read your poem from the collection for us.
I certainly will. This poem is called Gyre. We can talk about it later if you like, but I could also say that it reflects a time when I was physically searching the waters for my two stepsons who had drowned one night in an unexplained event. And all the things that I found that weren't them. I did have stepsons. No, I should say I do. And I did look for them, but I should say I didn't find them. No one found them. I should say that my stepsons were not found, unless you count those few bones, that tattered shirt, the Levi's that lasted all those months in the kelp. And did you know that kelp beds, the kind that are impossible to propel your kayak over or through, the kind that make a carpet on the sea, one that makes you believe you can walk on water, did you know that those kelp beds are keepers? Whole collections, white styrofoam dots, water half drunk in plastic bottles with blue labels and blue lids, sleeping sea otters, sometimes more than one, half shells of mussels floating like blue Venetian gondolas in circular canals with no exits. Tiny minnows that leap for no reason and land not in water, but on blades of kelp some ridged, some smooth, all of them growing before your sunlit eyes, while the minnows, in their silver straight jackets, jerk and gasp. Deeps and shallows. These bones once dance the deer dance, played at stepping through water with exaggerated slowness. Blue heron, O great one, your disapproving side eye. Catch me if you can, a cormorant diving, flash of dark motion, not a hand waving. Paddle further. Crab float, orange and black, not a life jacket. Eyes becoming tunnels, arms becoming wood, legs becoming sea through the hull of my kayak, slippery boys becoming fish, becoming deer, becoming clouds. Every time I look, they are somewhere else, and me, the last to spot them. I dredge pop-eyed dreams, distended song bladders, and I should say that nothing is the past. I should say that I search circular canals with no exits, knowing I do have stepsons. I do. Nothing is the past. They are there in my ribcage, knocking.
Thank you so much for reading that. This poem for our listeners was originally published in Prairie Fire. It's in the Best Canadian Poetry Collection, I think for great reason. I really enjoyed reading this poem, and obviously a heavier piece, one that has to do with memory. And I wanted to ask you a question that has come up a lot as I've talked to the poets I have on this show, which is, you know, this is obviously a very personal poem. So I'm wondering how long you tend to wait after things happen like this to put pen to paper about them. Some people, it's a very quick turnaround. It can be very therapeutic to write about things like this. Some people need that time and space in between. I'm wondering what that looks like for you as a writer.
For me, it was definitely all of those things. So I did a lot of immediate writing. And I have iterations of this poem that reflected, it's almost like poetry journaling, where you're really collecting and writing down everything because it's so visceral and so meaningful. And your only way to make sense of it is to write it. But when you look at some of those poems, and how they came out, they're sometimes a bit unformed, and kind of knee-jerk reactive. They may still be very overstated with emotion, and they may not be conveying exactly what you intend, or maybe not doing it in a way that you intend. I worked with Kate Braid, interviewing her about poetic form at one point, and she was just saying, if you ever have a problem with a poem, put it into a form, and it might change it. So initially, I had tried a few different forms for Gyre. And then one day I threw it into a prose poem, and that really changed everything. And I've done this actually since, in fact, where I've thrown something into a prose poem where I haven't really worried about line breaks, and I've just sort of channeled all the little asides that distract from the material but add to it at the same time with the minutiae. And I did throw it into a prose poem, and then when I had some feedback from a particular poetry group that I was in at the time, people kept saying, well, why have you got it as a prose poem? It really feels like you need more space in here. You really need more space between the lines. And So then I put it into couplets, and it worked quite well in couplets. And then prairie, there was something about the couplets. Prairie Fire couldn't quite format it properly, and I said, "Well, let me think about it, and I'll see if I can move it into triplets, and then the formatting can change and bring the lines in a bit shorter." And I'm actually really happy with how some of the line breaks ended up when I reworked it, and I've really enjoyed since then. I've written several poems where I just started out very free flowing, and I've kind of tried to interrupt the OCD part of me that wants to put line breaks in, and decided to just let the material come out and not line break it, and then really think about it and add those in later.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a strategy I've been using too, actually, is writing things, just free writing a prose poem and then coming back and thinking about form afterwards. I love Kate Braid, so I'm very excited that you shared some advice from her, and that it is particularly useful for, I think, for me, because I have been thinking a lot about how to fit things into forms that I don't normally use. I was gonna ask as well about the three line stanzas in this poem. And it's kind of fun and interesting to know that they came out of a formatting sort of issue or experience. So that's really interesting. But I guess one thing I want to ask too, because you mentioned having to rejig the lines and find different endings for lines, obviously, when you format it this way. One of the other questions I ask a lot on this show, because it's one of my favorite questions and I'm always concerned with it as a poet, is how do you know where to end a line?
Well, I think advice that I got about that was from Sherwin Bitswe, who is a Navajo poet. He really said, you really want to break the lines on words that may require more reflection or more emphasis. I've looked at that in the poem where I've kind of broken it in places where I've felt like the emphasis is possibly needed. But with particularly with gyre, it is also a very I call it kind of almost a title poem. Part of the whole experience of looking for the boys was n navigating this massive spring tide that we had, where the water went down as low as it ever goes down, and it's some huge current sweeping out to sea. And I wanted to reflect that in the poem. And so I wanted this notion of carryover in the lines. And I did feel that I was able to break the lines in a way that still maintained that sweep of tidal current, or that flow of unstoppable, slightly unstoppable flow. And so I haven't, I don't, I've, I think it's mostly quite intuitive or instinctive with line breaks. But it is amazing. I mean, if you break poetry down into dollars per hour, the amount of time I can spend chewing over a line break makes me probably, making negative pay. And I don't think it's worth dwelling on that too long for most people who are poets, because I do think the amount of time we can spend, I think, is a personal thing that we want to do. And if you start thinking about financial remuneration, it's probably not good for your practice.
No, it never is for poets, is it? We never want to think about that sort of thing.
No.
I do have one more question for you, and I think it's the most difficult question, so I'm going to leave a bit of time for it. Obviously, this collection that your poem has been chosen to be a part of, editing these is a monumental task. I've done episodes for Best Canadian Poetry the past few years, and I think it started when Rob Taylor, who's helped me to organize these interviews, thank you, Rob, was editing the collection. And I remember hearing about what that experience was like and being like, wow, that's a lot of poems to read. That's a lot to know what you're picking out. And so I'm wondering, Joanna, I've asked this of the other guests that I've interviewed for this episode too. If you were editing Best Canadian Poetry yourself, what would be some of the things you would be looking for?
Do you mean editing in collecting the poems, or do you mean
Yes.
editing in so your particular selection?
Yes.
That's a very tricky thing because it involves so much reading. And I was just talking to a fellow poet yesterday who had been on the jury for a particular prize, and she was saying that one of the things she noticed was there was kind of a sameness to a lot of the poems that were being submitted for that prize, where they might express something that was outrageous or terrible, and then their response to it and express in the response. And she said it wasn't so much a visible formula, but that there was a sameness. And she wondered if that sameness was resulting from what people are learning in university. For instance, if they're doing an MFA, they might be l learning particular things that are that they're remembering to incorporate. But she said that for her, the things that stuck out were the poems that particularly diverged from this sameness. And she said that the poems were brilliant. They were all really brilliant and really good. There was a feel about them that was different. There was a feel about the ones that they selected that was different from the others. So I think that feeling and that approach is important to consider. And I do like the way it was considered in Best Canadian Poetry. I think Bardia did an interesting job of collecting, because he had some rhyming poems. There are some poems that are really quite short and sweet. Rob Taylor's is one of them too. I mean, I really connected with that one because I was a parent in lockdown as well. I love the variety of voices in here, and some of which I identify with more than other voices. I grew up in Trinidad, so I instantly went to, oh goodness. Well, I actually really enjoyed, there are so many that I really enjoyed, but there was a this one right here, if I can get the actual title. Yes, from Sarah Lachman Singh, he hasn't arrived and someone has turned on the street lights. I don't know if it was just somehow I felt like I connected with her Guyanese background or something like that, but oh, there was so much anticipation in that poem. And she keeps it as anticipation the whole way through. I found in this particular edition that there was a really broad range. And I enjoy sometimes when people write a poem after another poem. So another particular standout for me in this one was a cartographer maps his way out of his country by Olajide Saluwa after Kai Miller, and it's about Nigeria. And I really like that as well because I find it sends you back to the original poem as well. So you get it's like you get two poems for the price of one. which I find particular. The voice is important to me. The poet's voice. I do like to hear it. It doesn't always need to overwhelm you, but I do like to hear a particular voice, whether it's that poet's voice all the time, or whether it's that poet's voice in that particular instance. I do like a feeling of a voice of some sort. And whether it's actually the voice of the poem itself, but whatever that voice is, I do like when I'm carried with that particular notion of voice, and perhaps voices, in fact. And I think perhaps that's what I liked about that poem about the cartographer, because he's talking about Nigeria. He does use dialect. It does feel very real to me, in some ways, terribly so. But I think that needing to be moved in ways that are very present, is important, for me as a reader. Something that and perhaps that visceral sense of being moved is more important for me than something that's perhaps very well crafted, but doesn't quite have that same punch for me.
Interesting.
Obviously, very, very subjective.
No, I really like that answer. I love the idea of looking for a specific voice or a momentum to the poem or an energy to the poem. I think that's something that's been done really well in this collection, so listeners, another reason to grab it. But yeah, that was my last question. Joanna, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I was so excited to sit down after I read this poem. And congratulations on being included in the anthology. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much, Andrew, and thanks for featuring the anthology on your podcast, and good luck with your podcast. I've caught a few of your issues, and you've interviewed some lovely and very interesting poets, so I'm excited to hear more from you.
Well, here we are, everybody, at the end of yet another Best Canadian Poetry episode, this one for 2024. I want to quickly thank each of the poets that I had a chance to speak to for this episode. None of them have been on the show before, but I was thrilled to get them all on the show this time around. I want to thank Rob Taylor as well for helping me to organize this, and thank you to Biblioasis as well for helping set this up. Again, if you're in Vancouver and you've somehow magically got a ticket to this sold-out, highly demanded event, Best Canadian Poetry 2024 reading on Tuesday the 20th, that's coming up next week, folks. This is a reminder to go. You gotta go. And if you can't go, listen to this episode again. It's just as good. Well, actually, it's probably not. They're really fantastic readers. They'll be great. But listen back, get some more of this, and definitely check out Best Canadian Poetry 2024. I've been doing this whole episode. I don't know if I've mentioned yet that this is a physical book that you can purchase at your local bookstore, or online, and there's a link to do so below this episode. Without much else to add, I will see you in a month with another interview. Can't wait to come back with another one, and we'll be back to it's a standard book of poetry next time. So back with a really great poet, I'm anticipating. And I will see you in March. Until then, my name is Andrew French. I'm on Instagram at Andrew W. French. And this, of course, has been Page Fright.